throughout our history, presidents have come to this chamber to speak to Congress, to the nation, and to the world, to declare war, to celebrate peace, to announce new plans and possibilities. Tonight, I come to talk about crisis and opportunity, about rebuilding the nation, revitalizing our democracy, and winning the future for America.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon from WNYC News, in for Tanzina Vega this week. The Biden-Harris administration has now clocked 100 full days since taking the mantle of leading this country during one of the most challenging times in American history. For most presidents, this is when both critics and supporters, mostly journalists to be honest, take a shot at giving an early grade on how the president is succeeding or failing at the job so far. So Biden grabbed the reins of the 100 days narrative with a speech to Congress and has proposed a $1.8 trillion plan to fund paid family leave and medical leave, affordable child care, tuition-free community college, and a variety of other programs.
To win that competition for the future, in my view, we also need to make a once-in-a-generation investment in our families and our children. That's why I've introduced the American Families Plan tonight.
The American Families Plan comes on the heels of the $1.9 trillion jobs and infrastructure package proposed by the White House last month. But the bill faces a difficult path in Congress, where many Republicans oppose additional large spending measures and tax increases. We're joined today by Congresswoman Catherine Clark, who represents the 5th District of Massachusetts. Representative Clark, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Nancy.
What is your reaction to Biden's comments on the American Families Plan during his speech last night? What stood out to you?
You know, I was so excited to hear the president speak last night of the fundamentals of our economy that we need to make investments in to ensure that when we recover from the economic fallout of this pandemic, it is not just back to status quo, but it is more inclusive. And one of the most devastating parts of what has happened since the pandemic is the effect on women in the workplace. We have seen 2 million women leave the workforce. We're at a 33-year low for women's participation. And we know the reasons. And so many of those fundamental reasons are addressed in the Families Plan. Expanding paid leave so people don't have to choose between their job and caring for a loved one. Making sure there's affordable, accessible childcare. We saw what happened in the pandemic when there weren't places to care for our children and educate our youngest learners. And to make sure that we can have universal pre-K and 2 years of free community college so that we can give our workforce of the future the skills they are going to need. So for me, this was seeing the American people and responding to their needs in this time of great challenge with great progress.
Let's talk a little bit more about childcare. It's obviously, it was an issue before the pandemic, as you said. What are the structural issues that the plan addresses that existed pre-pandemic?
Childcare always existed on the thinnest of margins in the best of times. And so what we saw were massive layoffs of childcare providers, childcare shuttering. My virtual guest last night to the state, to the address to Congress, was a woman named Jessica, who is a childcare provider in my district. And her story is the story of childcare. And she had to close down when the pandemic hit. And it was through a PPP loan, through the CARES Act, that she was able to reopen this fall. But the funding in the American Rescue Plan is going to let her build back even stronger. She is going to be able to expand. And if she had funding and parents and families were able to have universal pre-K, she is going to not only have a thriving business, but families that she cares for are going to be able to save up to $13,000 a year. This is real money in people's pockets, and this is a boost for our education system that will not only be great for families, but will also increase our global competitiveness.
How are we doing in a global sense? What are other countries doing in terms of their child care policies and support for families?
You know, we are behind. We have for too long defined child care as a private decision between parents and providers. And what the president's speech recognized last night and the policies that he is putting forth is that childcare is economic infrastructure. And if we make this investment, we are making an investment in American families and in our own economic success. It will not only create jobs, it is going to help us keep those jobs. And childcare really is just one example of what we can look at going back to women in our economy. 96% of childcare providers and small business owners of childcare centers and businesses are women. And predominantly, those are women of color. And what we have, unlike other countries around the world, is a social safety net that is too often built on the back of free labor from women or underpaid labor. Childcare is a glaring example of this. Too many women are working full-time or more in childcare and yet unable to provide for their own families. So what President Biden is saying is not only are we going to expand childcare access for families, but we're going to address this other very real component for women and women of color and make sure that there is a base salary and wage of $15 an hour for childcare providers, that there's a path through TEACH grants to have a higher education that can lead to a higher wage for them. So this is a good news story about how we value the work of women, how we make sure that we are building back to an economy that is more equitable and is more fair.
Republican Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina gave the Republican rebuttal speech. He didn't actually address the American Families Plan, but mostly talked about race and the political divide in the country. Let's play one particular moment, and then afterwards we'll get your reaction.
From colleges to corporations to our culture, people are making money and gaining power by pretending we haven't made any progress at all, by doubling down on the divisions we've worked so hard to heal. You know this stuff is wrong. Hear me clearly. America is not a racist country.
Your thoughts, Representative Clark?
You know, I think we are at this moment in our country's history where we are taking a hard and unblinking look at how racism has permeated every institution that we have. And it is long past time that we do this evaluation, that we look at how we bridge the divide, not by saying it doesn't exist or by turning away, but by looking at the experience of Black and Brown Americans through our history. And we plot a different course for the future. Let's make those ideals that we talk about of equality and justice for all become reality. And how do we do that? The blueprint was laid before us last night. We look at it. We talk about racism. We talk about working together to reform our police so that every mom has the security when they send their children out that they won't be harmed by anyone because of the color of their skin. Let's make sure that opportunity exists in our economy for everyone. And, you know, continuing to deny that racism and the toxic roots of slavery are not in every institution that we have, it does not make it go away. It solidifies the effects of racism in our daily lives. And if this pandemic has taught us anything, it's that we are so intertwined. Our success is so dependent on the success of our neighbors. And that looking at this, all of us, unblinkingly, is the path forward. And I was, you know, so moved to hear Joe Biden take this on directly, to talk about George Floyd's daughter and how his murder had also led us to a place where we could not look away any longer, and that we have to keep fighting for accountability that can lead us to true justice. So, you know, and to hear the president speak about violence against trans people, all of these pieces, when we are looking at where we need to do better, takes us to a stronger community and a stronger country. So I am delighted that that's where this administration's focus is, pulling these pieces together so that we can truly emerge from this pandemic in a place of strength and community.
All good stuff, but it may just come down to whether or not the Democrats have a plan for how to pay for all of these things, right? I mean, that's going to be a big part of this in as it winds its way through Congress. So tell us, what's the proposal for how to pay for all of this?
Yeah, I think what the president laid out last night is right. Let's reward work and not wealth. Let's ask the wealthy, who nobody begrudges their success, but let's ask them to pay their fair share and to make sure that we are rebalancing this economy and the investments we need to make so that working families around this country are put first, and that those with great wealth, we're talking about the top 0.3% of Americans in wealth in this country, are pulling their fair weight. And that goes for large corporations. You know, some of our largest, like Amazon, paid zero in taxes, while we have 12 million children in this country going to bed hungry every night. It is long past time that we make sure that everyone contributes fairly and equitably so we can make these investments in the American family and in their success.
Congresswoman Catherine Clark represents the 5th District of Massachusetts. Representative Clark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nancy. So good to be with you.
We're going to continue the conversation about what this means for women. We're joined by C. Nicole Mason, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Nicole, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Nancy. It's really an exciting time to be here having this conversation.
And Katie B. Garner, Executive Director of the International Association of Maternal Action and Scholarship. Katie, good to have you with us.
Hello, Nancy. Thank you so much. Definitely a pleasure to be here.
So, Nicole, let's start with you. We had you on the show a few weeks back after President Joe Biden introduced his infrastructure plan, which included $400 billion for the care economy. The American Families Plan, which he unveiled last night, was a promised follow-up. So what are your initial reactions?
So I think the American Families Plan is a very ambitious, transformative package that will deliver for the American people who have been crunched by rising housing costs, childcare costs, and other expenses. It really takes some of the burden off of them. And I spent all night crunching the numbers, and the savings are going to be tremendous directly to families. So it's what we've been asking for and what we've needed for so long. And I'm ready to see it be delivered to the people.
Katie, do you have anything to add in terms of the overall response?
I think my first reaction to this was very much as Ms. Nicole's was. I think everybody who's been doing this work for several decades, myself included, have been asking for this type of support that very much puts us in line with what other countries are doing. So that's a huge win. And I think for the most part, my reaction has been that this is smart policy development. Historically, we've had a hard time getting legislation through that targets historically marginalized communities specifically. And while this plan does not leave those folks out of the equation, there's plenty of support for those that are just trying to get a grab on the middle class and keep that hold there. And so I think that targeting both those aspects is really critical to having this go through.
Even prior to the pandemic, you had spent time traveling around the country talking to women and to mothers about their experiences and the tough choices they have to make to take care of their family and work a career. So tell us a little bit about that. What did you hear from women as you traveled around the country?
I think that's been one of my big takeaways, is that when you talk to women about whether or not they want to go back to what life was like before COVID, the answer is a resounding no, because women were not thriving then. And we're not just talking those that we consider to be on the cusp under traditional circumstances, single mothers, mothers of color, but really across the board, mothers have felt under-supported and for good reason. So I mean, I've seen women, I think the two things that really sort of tug at me are the number of women that feel that they can't have a second child because the cost of childcare is just so high for them. I don't think that having a second child should be something that is that impossible to ask for or to want. And the number of women that have said that they're working shifts that are totally opposite of their spouse and not seeing that person at all, and the strain that that puts on families. But that's the only way that they can make the child care cost numbers work for them. And those are really hard things to hear, that child care is ultimately changing the fabric of American families and not for the better.
And the pandemic made that so much harder. Nicole, so many women, and particularly women of color, have been forced to leave the workforce over the last year. What does this plan do to support reentry?
It does a lot. So one of the chief reasons why women exited the workforce en masse, especially around August and September, is because of school closures and daycare closures, inadequate care. And so this plan does much to support not only child care workers, but also families directly. I spent the evening crunching the numbers, and under Biden's plan, in New York City, for example, families would save $11,000 a year on infant care and more than $4,000 on care for four-year-olds. And, you know, that is tremendous. That's money in the pockets of families. And when women feel like they have high-quality child care, they feel comfortable going to work. They can look for a job. They can, sustain employment over time. So this plan is a real game changer for families.
And given the disproportionate impact the pandemic had on women of color, is that going to be addressed in this plan?
It is addressed in this plan, especially when we talk about care workers. So the $40 billion per year in the infrastructure plan for care workers is really significant, because most of those workers are women of color. So raising the wages there and making sure that they can, earn a living wage. And then when we think about Biden's plan around child care, if you earn the state median's income, you only pay 7% of that of your income on care, or if you earn 100 up to 150%. And that will be significant in terms of, again, money directly going back into people's pockets. And for women of color and some women who have lower than the state median earnings, they will pay nothing for care. Making this plan more accessible, making more families be able to tap into childcare supports will go a long way to improving women's long-term and short-term economic security and well-being.
Nicole, you know, a lot has been said about whether care is part of infrastructure. So, you know, what does that mean exactly? I mean, does this create a care infrastructure, and what does that mean?
So the American Families Plan is a start to creating a childcare, a really robust and strong childcare infrastructure in the United States. It's long overdue. And so when I think about care and how I think childcare, elder care, and how we should think about it, we should think about childcare as a public good, because we know that we've seen it in during the pandemic that when women lost care, they exited the workforce, and that impacted their earnings, and it also impacted the strength of the economy. So thinking about childcare as a necessity, a public good, the same way we do roads and bridges, would go a long way to making sure that women are able to sustain employment, but also would contribute so much if we had the labor force participation, say, of women like the country of Norway. $16.9 billion a year to the GDP. So when we think about the benefits of a, you know, childcare for all or universal childcare system, we know that it benefits women, it benefits families, it benefits employers, and definitely benefits the economy.
Katie, when you talk to mothers around the country, what do you hear besides childcare? What are the issues that come up that they need, and where do we see that in this plan?
Well, I think that's one of the things that is missing, is that a lot of mothers want to have humane work conditions and work conditions that recognize care work as being part of people's lives. Right now, that is not something that we see much of. I mean, I've talked to several women that are actually working full time to be in the red because childcare costs so much, feminized labor is so undervalued, that we're in the situation where women are having to step out of work or else rack up credit card bills just to pay for their chance to stay on the career ladder. So we need work that is fair, equitably reimbursed. And I think we need to look at how we've structured this in terms of white women oftentimes relying on Black and brown women to stay in the workforce. And I don't know if that's fully addressed in this plan, as some of those cultural aspects that have been brewing for quite some time.
There is family medical leave is one of the aspects. That seems like that would also help to be able to take time off work to take care of your family when someone's sick.
Absolutely. And again, this is something that we have 1 in 4 women right now going back within 2 weeks of giving birth. And I've heard from women that have not used that time right after birth, even when their child's in the NICU, because they don't want to use up their vacation time during a time when their child's being cared for in the hospital. These are inhumane conditions that we would look at another country doing and be very upset with. But we're permitting that here, I think, in large part because of rugged individualism.
Okay, thanks so much, Nicole, Katie. Nicole Mason is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and Katie B. Garner is the Executive Director of the International Association of Maternal Action and Scholarship. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you so much.
So we asked you, what is your household struggling with, and what support do you need from the federal government?
Hello, this is Jane Stackhouse in Portland, Oregon. I need the government to support affordable housing for all. I have a house, and it breaks my heart to see people living on the street. I'm not comfortable inviting an unknown person into my house. I would be happy to have affordable, subsidized housing in my neighborhood. Not the big projects of the past, but housing integrated so our communities become more diverse economically, ethnically, and socially.
What support is needed from the federal government? Well, I need a job. I'm a political scientist specializing in modern China, especially its security and intelligence services. But in spite of the alleged demand for information about that topic, there are no jobs out there especially at our underfunded state universities, and I'm not the only one looking. Does our government want Americans to better understand China, or do they just want to fool around? I'm Matt Brazil in San Jose, California.
I need the federal government to create an equitable national medical health care system for all. If they did that one thing and did it as well as other countries do, it would improve pretty much everything in all of our lives.
Hi, my name is Charlie. I live in Seattle. And with the pandemic, been struggling with the whole thought of, you know, I need to do things so I don't become homeless. And there's been so much of that here and just around the country, too. I'm about to graduate, and it's just so scary. Everything that's been going on, it's been hard to work even as a veteran with a GI Bill to get school done. Food is also a concern. Food insecurity is definitely a thing. It's pretty expensive to live here in Seattle. Yeah, it's sad to get pushed out of the city because of the pandemic, but that's kind of what it's doing. But things are looking better, so.
Hi, this is Sam calling from Tacoma, Washington. I was just thinking that if the federal government were to do a fiscal stimulus plan, it should make that money tax-free. Needy families who need that money are going to use it immediately, and they're going to pay off rent or pay down credit card debt or pay off their utility bill. And then how are they going to find the funds at the end of the year to go pay taxes on money that they didn't have in the first place? It's kind of like, you know, giving help and then asking for part of it back. So if that money is supposed to be taxed, then the IRS should withhold that tax initially and then just send out the remainder. Check, check.
So good to hear from you out there. You can always reach us by calling 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or by clicking Contact Us on thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This week, students at Yeshiva University in New York filed a lawsuit against their institution because the university has refused to formally recognize an LGBTQ club. For over 2 years, students have been trying to formally create a gay-straight alliance club at the university, which is a private modern Orthodox Jewish research school in New York. The school has reportedly received funds from New York State, and by refusing to recognize the LGBTQ student club, students claim it has violated their human rights. This instance raises questions on private religious institutions and the future of LGBTQ acceptance within the Orthodox Jewish community. I'm joined now by Simone Somek, correspondent for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. Simone, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Nancy, for having me.
So,
an outside organization. The students tell me that this was a last resort, the decision to file a lawsuit for discrimination against the university.
It's not hard to understand why they are arguing that they're being discriminated against, but what legal basis do they have to make that argument?
So this is a very interesting case because the university about 50 years ago registered as a non-sectarian corporation and therefore has been receiving state funds as a consequence of that. And the students are saying that the university is violating New York City human rights law and is actively discriminating LGBTQ students, while in the meantime accepting all sorts of other clubs, student clubs such as Women in STEM or College Republicans, College Democrats, all sorts of clubs that all universities have.
So tell us more about Yeshiva University for those who aren't familiar with it. And also, what does it mean for them to say they're non-sectarian? Like, what does that mean? And then tell us more about the university overall.
So Yeshiva University is one of the most prominent Jewish modern Orthodox institutions in the United States, and I would say even in the world. And it finds itself in a very tricky position when it comes to LGBTQ issues. It's torn between two currents. On one side, you have the modern Orthodox world, which is slowly but increasingly becoming more open to the acceptance of LGBTQ Jews and people in general. And on the other hand, you have the more traditional Orthodox world in which this is still a very contentious and controversial issue. And Yeshiva University wants to be accepted by the Orthodox world and does not want to be seen as too modern. However, by registering as a non-sectarian institution, Yeshiva University is not protected as a religious institution, and therefore the lawsuit says that it should not discriminate against LGBTQ students and it should allow them to have a club.
So you mentioned that modern Orthodox Judaism has become a little more accepting of LGBTQ rights. So tell us a little more about that. In what ways has that movement moved a bit?
So the Jewish law, the traditional interpretation of Jewish law, halacha, does not allow homosexual relations. And therefore, as in many other religions, LGBTQ issues have been a very problematic issue. However, as society changes and the newer generations are becoming more and more open to this on these issues, even in the modern Orthodox world, you start seeing more acceptance, at least more de facto than the jure, I would say. So modern Orthodox rabbis still would not celebrate a gay wedding. However, de facto in the communities and in schools, you start seeing more acceptance and openness.
So tell us about some of the students who are filing the lawsuit. What do we know about them?
The students have been very passionate about this issue. They say that it's important for them to have a club, also for the university to send a message of acceptance to LGBTQ students who do not at the moment feel comfortable coming out of the closet at university with the rabbis, with the faculty, with their own families. So by not accepting this club, the university, they claim, is sending a message of intolerance, and it's fostering an environment in which students will not feel comfortable coming out.
And where do you see this going? I mean, if the students were to win the lawsuit, does this then expand out to, say, you know, the many, many Christian colleges there are all over New York, if not all over the country?
I think this case, this lawsuit, has the potential to become quite a high-profile case because the university does not seem to want to back down, and the students are very, very determined to win. So I've been speaking to their lawyers, and I've read the lawsuit. I think they have a strong case against the university, and it's going to be really interesting to see how the university plans to defend itself. For now, at the moment, the university has put out a statement saying that their policies on harassment and discrimination against students on the basis of all protected classifications, including LGBTQ students, are strong and vigorously enforced. However, they still remain firm in their position that they will not recognize such club on campus.
Simone Somek is a correspondent for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. Simone, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nancy.
So, does anybody remember laughter? In such a dark moment, there hasn't always been a lot to joke about. And even those of us who wanted to go see live comedy shows usually had to resort to Zoom. Not exactly the most seamless format for comedians to try out new material. But this spring, things are starting to look a bit different. A year after shutting their doors, many live comedy venues in New York, Los Angeles, and other cities around the country are finally welcoming audiences back in. It's an experience that might feel jarring at first for both the performers and the people watching them, but hopefully it can also bring back some much-needed joy. Natalie Palamides is a comedian who thrives on interactions with the audience in her work, and she's here with me now to discuss getting back out there and performing for them. Thanks for being here, Natalie.
Hey, Nancy. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Thanks for joining us. So before we get to some of your recent live performances, how do you generally approach interactions with audience members when you're doing shows?
Well, I guess it depends what stage the work is in, but I guess if when I'm developing material, I try to feel out, you know, who's willing to play with me in the audience, you know, just kind of based on how they're looking at me. If they're looking like they're enjoying themselves, I'll engage with them. And yeah, a lot of the times when I'm first figuring out a new piece, I'll just improvise with an audience member and kind of see where an interaction goes. And then if that interaction goes well, I try to figure out a way to make it happen kind of that same time every time I do the show.
Yeah. And have you been able to do anything on Zoom this past year in terms of working out new material with audiences, or does it just not work?
I'm not really one for Zoom. I did a couple Zoom shows. They're all right, but, you know, I was kind of suffering doing the Zoom shows. I got saved. One of my bits was bombing pretty badly during a Zoom show, but I got saved by my neighbor across the street yelling at me for being too loud, and people really enjoyed that.
How perfect.
Yeah, so that kind of worked out, especially because I was playing this like wicked witch, and it was fun to interact with my neighbor as this witch. So that kind of improvisation there was, you know, serendipitous and saved my butt in that situation. But what kind of my friends and I have turned to is doing outside shows. So we actually do this outside show once a week in Griffith Park called Clown Zoo, and it's just a free show. And I live direct a bunch of my friends as this high status idiot character called Mrs. Skin, while all my friends perform together in theatrical masks. And so we thought of using theatrical masks so that people could wear their COVID masks beneath it. And so it kind of became this little loophole that we thought of. But all of my friends are clowns. You know, we're not really trained in masks. So it took a while for us to learn how to use the mask as a tool. But I think we got a pretty good handle on it now. And the shows have been really fun. Yeah.
And what was it like to get in front of an actual crowd again?
Oh, man. I mean, every week after the show, we just all feel like, a huge rush. It's a good feeling, even though, you know, everyone's sitting kind of in the grass, socially distant, and the laughs don't feel as impactful because you are outside and the laughter, you know, dissipates more easily than when you're like shoved in a black box theater with a bunch of people. But man, it feels good, Nancy. I gotta say, just to be able to see people's eyes and there's something different when you feel a laugh in person as opposed to over the internet, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone's nodding their head with you at this point. Even meetings are the same. They're just, it's like talking into the void. Hard to get that response back and forth. And So what's it feel like in terms of, like, I would imagine that, you know, maybe you haven't had as much chance to work out material with a live audience, but that there is what economists would call pent-up demand, that people are just so hungry for performance and laughter that do you notice a difference right now versus pre-pandemic?
Maybe I feel less pressure now to make something really good because, excuse me, everybody understands that comedians haven't been able to work anything out. So I guess I feel like a little more freedom to just kind of mess around. And I mean, I kind of always felt that way to just, that's kind of how I make stuff, is just by throwing stuff up on stage and not worrying about how good it's going to be. Although that's always part of it. I don't know. It's nuanced, you know, Nancy, but yeah, I'm not, I don't know if there's too much of a difference in terms. I think people are excited to see shows again, but I don't know. I think that they're always excited to come see shows. Yeah, that's an enjoyable thing, seeing comedy, isn't it?
Yeah. At one point in your Netflix special, you wrestle with an audience member. Seems like you're not going to be able to do that for now. Or does that actually make it better? Like, you're transgressing even more now to have physical contact with someone in the audience?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that I might not be able to do it now, because I've had a couple producers reach out to me to put up that show that you're speaking about. And then one of my other solo shows that I have where I also interact with the audience quite a bit, they're asking me to remount them. And I'm like, you guys have seen these shows, right? Like, I don't know how COVID friendly they are. I don't know what the protocol would be. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would, if I did perform Nate again live, I guess probably I would have to play the post-pandemic reality as part of the bit. You know, maybe the wrestling bit would change a little bit. Like, I'd bring them up to wrestle me, but the joke would maybe end up being more that I can't touch them. And so how do you figure out a way to wrestle somebody or bring that energy to it without actually touching them? I don't know. We'd see. Or maybe I get them to sign some sort of consent, or maybe a gag would be to bring a temperature checker with me before I wrestle them, something like that. So I feel like there's ways to use the current reality and make light of it. Of course, not make light of, you know, the disease or the pandemic, but just to bring a little lightness to it, see if you can use it.
Natalie Palamides is a comedian whose Netflix special is called Nate, a one-man show. Natalie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Thursday in the books. Phew. We appreciate you being along for the ride. Remember, this entire show and all of our segments are available at thetakeaway.org each and every day. So if you missed even a single moment and want to listen back, we got you covered. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Nancy Solomon, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.